Well.
My name is Tyler Byrne. You're listening to a new episode of Lo-Fi Lit. This is a little podcast I host. I talk to authors, publishers, and like anyone else that I find to be interesting or just I want to talk to. People I just find across the internet, the World Wide Web. I've been a fan of internet literary spaces and venues for over 10 years, probably 15 years now. As time moves on. Today I'm talking to D.T. Robbins. D.T. Robbins is the author of Leasing, which was published by House of Vlad in 2024. He also runs Rejection Letters. It's published people like Graham Irvin, I Have a Gun. Many other books you go check out. Recently, he published Pocket Universes on X-Ray Lit Magazine. So you can go check that out. Excellent story. I just read it. This is a great interview. I appreciate DT for coming on. We recorded this about 2 months ago, so it's been waiting to come out. Got a lot of cool interviews coming out tomorrow. I'm talking to someone that I'm excited to talk about or talk with. In this interview, we talk about DT living in California, starting a bookstore with his friends, whether he would do that or not. Talk about art, talk about his time working as a textbook guy, editor, textbook editor, for a school that like ran its own in-house textbooks, that they published their own stuff. I found that to be really fascinating. It just seems like the perfect setting for an absurdist story. He likes to write absurdist stuff. That's his style. Later we talk about another story called Pete that, is also on X-Ray Lit Mag. You can check that out. Check those stories out over there. X-Ray Lit Mag, definitely a great publication to read and check out, a lot of the time, most of the time, all the time. He's also friends with Aaron Birch, Kevin Maloney, Kyle Seibel. He runs with those groups of people and many others. That's Lo-Fi Lit. Thanks for listening, everyone. See you guys later. Bye.
Yeah, I'm in SoCal. I'm in the Inland Empire of SoCal, so about 45 minutes to an hour east of LA. So okay. Suburbia.
So yeah. Did you get like hit by the fires at all?
No, we didn't. So that was over by trying to think. Altadena was the closest place to us that got hit, and that's about 30 minutes away. So no, okay. We were safe from all that. We get fires a lot over here, but we're like our neighborhoods are far enough away from where it typically happens that it's not that much of a risk or a threat, I should say.
Was it close enough though that you're getting concerned?
Not for us. My wife's best friend though, she lives in Altadena, and her house didn't catch on fire, but her neighborhood did. There's an elementary school right across from where she lives, and it just like burned down to the ground, and she's not able to go back into her house yet just because of all the chemicals and smoke and all that shit. And so there's a lot of people who are still kind of displaced from that right now.
Were you thinking though, like, do you have a plan if like that was going to hit by, if that would have like hit you?
No, not that. I mean, we have insurance. That's the best I could say is like, at least we know we have that. I think when it comes to shit like that, I usually sort of, obviously it's nothing you ever want to experience. But the biggest concern is always just, you know, my family's safety. That's it. So long as everybody's okay and healthy, shit can be replaced. You know what I mean? Everything else can, a house, we have, like I said, we got insurance and all that shit. So that's, that can be replaced. It's not that much of a concern in that regard. But then again, I've never had it so close. So my opinion may change if we ever are under that kind of threat.
You guys ever think about moving away from there?
We think about it a lot. It's not something that's exactly doable for us in the moment, or at this moment. So I have two older kids from a previous marriage, mm-hmm. and I share 50-50 custody with their mom. So part of the, you know, court order is we always have to stay within, I want to say it's like 30 miles of each other, which is a good thing for the kids, simply because we want them to have that stability. I want to be around them, obviously, as much as possible. And I want them to be around their mom as much as possible, you know. So, you know, it's not, well, I think, you know, my wife and I have talked a lot about like moving maybe like to San Diego later. I think that would be sort of, that's top of where I'd love to go. I love San Diego. Although we did just get back from New York. I've never been to New York except for the first time last week. I loved it out there. But again, that's, you know, it's all hypotheticals. It's, you know, I don't know if we with kids could ever live in the city. I know people do it. I don't think I could. But I loved the East Coast. It was rad as hell.
Did you go up there for a reading?
No. It was our anniversary. So it was our 5-year anniversary. We had up there and just kind of took a little, you know, 5-day vacation, and it was great, man. Just got to see the city for the first time. Yeah, I did all the, go ahead.
Did you think about taking her to a reading for your anniversary?
You know, she's nice enough to where she probably would have like entertained it just to be nice to me. No, I wouldn't have done that to her. I didn't even think about that while we were out there. The closest we came to anything like literary wise was like, we went to a bookstore in Brooklyn. That was like the closest we came to, which was cool because like, it's a smaller bookstore. I mean, it wasn't small by any stretch of the imagination, if I'm being honest. But it was rad because there was a lot of small press in their store, and I loved seeing that, you know. So yeah,
is that not the case in California?
I mean, I'm living in suburbia, so the closest we have is like Barnes and Noble. Uh-huh. And you know, I don't shop at Barnes and Noble anyway. It's just not, they, you know, it's mostly all the bestseller shit that they have. But when I've gone to like, you know, shop in LA or San Diego, they'll have small press. The bookstore I typically go to in San Diego is a great store called the Book Catapult. And they, you know, have a lot of small press. And a lot of that is because my fiction editor, Kevin Carney, he hosts a small press night every quarter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's just been like a big influx of small press attention because of that. But I think it also depends on like what kind of small press books do you look for? Because there's a fuck ton of like small presses. You know what I mean? They're a dime a dozen. Let's just be honest about it. So it's for me, like I kind of look for, you know, the usual. Like I like a lot of Clash books, $2 Radio, Autofocus. Trying to think, those are the ones that come top of mind. And then a lot of authors too, you know, like when I was at the store in Brooklyn, I was looking at some horror books and found CJ Lead. I wouldn't consider her small press, but you know, just people that you know or have you are acquaintances with or know through somebody else or whatever the case is. So it's nice to see some like names that I recognize or whatever the case is.
I was going to ask, you used to work at Barnes & Nobles. Do you think if Barnes & Noble started like selling, like what would they have to do to like get like short or small presses into the store? And then if they did like put small presses into the store, do you think it would do better business?
So I used to work at Borders.
Borders.
What's that?
This is the same thing.
Same thing, yeah. I don't know, man. I know I want to say Clash has a couple titles in Barnes & Noble. I don't want to say that they don't have any small press. I just know that the times I've gone in, I've not seen any that I'm aware of. You know, because I don't want somebody's small press getting pissed off saying, well, we're in there, you know, whatever. But I want to say Clash is probably big enough to where they have, and I don't even know if you'd really consider Clash small press. That's probably unfair. Maybe they're just closer proximity to some of the other, you know, larger, big presses. But anyway, to get them in the store, I feel like it's possible. I think it's just a matter of like making the right connections. I don't know how those big stores do shit as far as like buying anything, you know, how their buyers work, what they look for. I think if a small prep were to make or to develop a relationship with one of the buyers, then it's possible to get like a small influx of small. Where it goes from there, who fucking knows? Right? It may not. It's hard to tell. I don't know. You know,
I could see like Bud Smith, like in a Borders or Barnes and Nobles. I mean, Borders, they bankrupt and no longer around, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. No, I think Bud's books would definitely. He probably already has some in Barnes & Noble, at least Teenager. I think Teenager for sure is probably already in quite a few Barnes & Nobles. That wouldn't surprise me in the least, you know.
You ever want to start your own bookstore?
Actually, yeah, that's kind of one of the things I've always wanted to do.
Oh, for real?
Yeah. I talked to my wife about it quite a bit over the past couple years. It would definitely be a smaller bookstore. I've always had the idea, and I don't think it's anything necessarily, novel, but I think being over here in suburbia and then also close to, we have a town next to us called Claremont, which is a little bit like a small college town. I always thought it would be really cool to have like a small bookstore that also kind of doubled as like a tap room. So a couple local beers on tap, buy a beer, read a book, buy a book, all that kind of shit. And then focus on a lot of small press books, you know. The caveat to that being, I think at least if I'm being honest, majority of the money is coming from the beer at that point.
True.
But you know, you do what you got to do to keep your head afloat, I guess. Right.
Yeah. What would you call the bookstore?
No fucking clue right now.
No clue.
No idea. No, I haven't gotten that far.
Do you know enough about like breweries and shit to like look into that, I guess, or know about that?
Yeah, I have a couple friends who own tap rooms and breweries out here. So, you know, honestly, it's all just about making the connections and the relationships and then going from there. You know, if I don't know enough about it, I know somebody else who does who definitely going to help me along the way.
I just know when like the Asheville, like when they got hit, I was like learning about all this like brewery stuff because they were talking about how much destruction happened. Like they have to be constantly like cleaning out their giant distilleries and all that shit.
Yeah. That's
it must cost a lot of money. I'm just saying.
No, it's definitely, well, I mean, I think it would be more so. So there's also like, have you been to LA before?
No, never.
So there's a bookstore out here called Stories that, they'll have wine and they'll have beer. I don't think they have like a tap per se. So there's a way, there's ways to go about it without having to like hook up shit like that. I mean, if anything, you know, you can always work with breweries about getting their canned beers, you know, and selling those. And people also like, look, you'll have a hard time, in my opinion. You'll have a hard time not selling out of a $3 tall boy of PBR. It's going to go, you know what I mean? No matter where you're at, people will buy that shit because it's a cheap tall boy. So, you know, even stuff like that, just something where you can drink a beer, read a book. Yeah. I mean, there's always like coffee shop bookstores, which if coffee's your thing, that's cool. It's not, I drink a fuck ton of coffee, but I'm never like excited about going to get coffee. I'd rather go out and spend my money on, you know, food or beer.
Would you ever do like a food truck thing?
Where no.
You could set it up no. and like have people read and drink beer?
No. No, I mean, I would have a food truck come out to a bookstore. I could be involved in a food truck. I've never worked in the food industry in general. I've never worked in the food industry. So that terrifies me. I've heard so many fucking horror stories of people in the food industry where I'm just like, no, that's not for me. No, thank you.
Do you talk to your wife about other business ideas other than a bookstore?
I mean, I talk to her a lot about the press, about rejection okay. letters. I definitely, you know, bounce a lot of ideas off of her because she did, and still does. She has a photography business on the side where she was shooting weddings for a really long time. So like all the stuff that entails. So she's really good at that kind of stuff. Where I'm more so still, I feel like I mean, you're always learning, but I feel like I'm definitely learning. But yeah, I'll bounce ideas off of her. I also kind of have a couple of friends that I will reach out to, like Michael Wheaton from Autofocus. I'll text him, you know, probably more often than not about any kind of press questions, like, hey, how do you handle this? Or, you know, I had a question about like using a printer, a new printer not long ago, and he was giving me, you know, what he's done recently. So it's definitely nice to have people to bounce those ideas off of or to ask your questions to, because I mean, I don't think I could have done what I'm doing now, publishing books, without having a couple people to sort of like, you know, confer with.
Would you ever go into business with like Aaron and Kevin Maloney? You guys?
Hell no.
No,
I love those guys to death, but absolutely not, for several reasons, and I hope they hear this. Kevin is an artist's artist, and I think he needs to be absolutely, I know he, which is so funny because like the man runs his own business, and that's like his day-to-day income, you know? And I'm sure he is phenomenal at it. So I'm not like trying to say he's like, you know, he would be bad at it or anything. But I just definitely feel like when it comes to this kind of shit, Kevin is very much so the kind of dude that needs to just be free to do his own thing and write when he needs to write. And I know he's doing the pool party with his fiance Ryan Ashley, and I know that's a whole thing too. I love him to death, but absolutely not. And then Aaron would be amazing, but I also feel like Aaron is one of those people who has done what he's done for a really long time and has a lot of really good advice. And, you know, I've definitely listened to him in a lot of ways. But I think at the end of the day, Aaron is also like, he has his hands in so much with like HAD and mm-hmm. writing his own books and everything, that I'd almost feel guilty both trying to take anything, any of that away from them and have them focusing on something like a press. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Also, I feel like, and this is the me side of it, I know I'm like kind of pointing a finger at them without like actually pointing a finger at them. I feel like I work very well on my own just because like typically when I make up my mind about something, I have to really be convinced to do otherwise. Like, I'm pretty tunnel vision when I know what I want to do. At least that's been my experience with rejection letters thus far. And I like that feeling, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So if they're like enthusiastic about it and like they were just paying all their attention to coming up with a bookstore, you'd still like turn them down?
Man, now I feel like you're asking questions I'm gonna get in trouble for. You know what, man, life is long. Who knows?
Is there anyone you'd work with in the small press industry or writers or whatever? Like Graham Urban or Bud Smith?
To like open a bookstore? No, and that's honestly, when I think about it, that's a me thing. I like being my own boss. I like being, you know, the one who is, I don't say in charge in the sense of like power by any stretch of the imagination, because anyone I've worked with, like any of the authors I've worked with, will all tell you like I'm very flexible with, you know, collaboration and stuff like that. So it's not like that aspect of it. I just sort of like that freedom, you know what I mean? And when I feel like I'm a partner with somebody, or at least the idea of being a partner with somebody in that regard, I don't feel that sense of freedom. So no. And that's genuinely with no disrespect to anybody whatsoever. It's just, that's a 100% me thing. And kind of like also the catalyst for why I've thought about having a bookstore and why I'm putting more into the press now is like, I work my whole life for somebody else. Like, I'm 41 years old. And obviously, you know, you can never tell where life's going to take you for sure, but I would love to be in a position, and I'm aiming for that, to be in a position one day where I'm not having to, you know, wait on somebody else to sign my checks or whatever the case is. I want to do this shit, you know, take care of it myself and be my own boss and make the decisions. And I like that freedom. I really, really like that freedom. So yeah, long-winded answer to your question.
So what if this hypothetical bookstore was going strong and you're running it yourself? Would you bring them in to work under you if they were down on their luck?
No. Oh, if they were down on their luck, that's a different situation. If they're down on their luck and they're like dependable. And when we say they, who is they? Are we still talking about Kevin and Aaron?
Yeah, and Graham Urban and Bud Smith and Scott McClanahan.
And Scott, I don't know Scott McClanahan. I've read his books, but I don't know him personally.
Kyle Seibel too.
Kyle Seibel, I would hire on looks alone, because he'd probably bring in people to fucking buy books and buy drink beer. So he would be a yes. All those dudes are such good dudes. It'd be hard to say no, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it would also be this very awkward, like, I don't want to be their boss kind of thing either. Like, in my mind, I guess my vision has always been like, and again, this is one of those things where like, who the fuck knows where life takes it. Like, let's just say hypothetically, I am able to open up a bookstore. It does do very well. In my mind, the people I would want to hire to work at the bookstore would be like my kids. Like, I would want to hire my kids to work at the store, get some work experience, that kind of stuff. If I were to hire anybody else to work in the store, I don't think I'd want to know them from the literary scene. Like, I feel like just to have that sort of separation would be nice. I mean, I know there's the old adage of like, you know, if be careful hiring your friends because blah, blah, blah. And I'll be honest, like, I haven't seen that play out in real life as a negative thing, but, all those dudes are such good dudes. It'd be hard to say no to them, but there would also be a very awkward thing between like, yeah, you're my homie, but also I'm your boss. I don't like that feeling. You know what I mean? Let me hire a complete stranger instead and then just be their boss. And then there's that separation there that I don't have to worry about. Fuck, like, you know, are they going to get pissed off at me because I scheduled them for this work day or whatever the case is? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. How well is rejection letters doing as a press?
We're rich. No, I'm just kidding. I would say, you know, I'm happy with where we're headed. Yeah, honestly, man, like I think I don't want to give away too much because I'm waiting on some stuff to finalize. But yeah, no, we're doing well. I in my opinion, we're doing well. I also don't know what that means in comparison to other small presses. You know what I mean? Like I can't tell you how we're doing financially versus something like Autofocus or Filthy Loot or any other, you know, smaller press out there. What I know is a lot of people told me going into this, like, you're gonna lose money, you're gonna lose money, you're gonna lose money. And that's not been the case, like at all. Not that I'm like fucking rolling in the dough over here. I'm definitely not, but like I'm definitely turning a profit. I'm able to pay my authors what they're due. There are strides forward to get the books out to like new audiences and new places that I'm excited about coming. I feel like I'm publishing some really fucking great books that I'm really, really happy with. And in that sense, it's like, yeah, on a fiscal level doing well, publication level doing well, mental and emotional level doing well. I feel like, you know, the authors are all happy. I've not had any complaints, at least, you know. Yeah.
Do you have a certain like particular number in your mind when you're selling a book that you want to reach?
No, I don't. Which is funny because like as a writer, you have this idea that of how many books you'd love to sell of your own book, which almost always leads to disappointment. Whereas as a publisher, I feel like I don't have a goal, at least not right now. You know what I mean? Because there's published or Mallory Smart published Birds Aren't Real from Maudlin House. And they've got great books too. I mean, Double Bird by Bud Smith, obviously. I remember her telling me that sometimes like a book will do really, really well during like pre-orders, and then sometimes it'll suck and then it won't take off for like a year. And I feel like I haven't had any publications that have like sucked when the pre-orders have come out or anything like that. But I've noticed a few that like just can I guess I've noticed a couple, I should say, that just like months after their publication, they just boom, blew up all of a sudden. And now I'm seeing more sales and stuff, which is awesome, A, for the press, and B, more importantly, I feel for the author, because there's that sense of validation, like, okay, I did write something that people enjoy. At least that's my take on it as an author as well.
Do you ever see like an author do something that like leads to their book being more successful, and then you think the other author should do that?
What do you mean? Like, at
You know, like
what?
Graham Irvin, he goes on Twitter and like he tries to get his book kind of like turned into a meme. Did that help the sale of his book?
You know what? Graham, first off, is such an incredible writer, just in general. He has such a reputation for being such a good writer. I think that alone helped just propel his book. I think it depends on the author's personality, their audience that they already have, and then, you know, trying new shit out as well. What Graham did trying to like turn I Have a Gun into a meme was funny and worked. I mean, it's hard to say because I don't have like analytics as far as like, well, where did these people come from? But I feel like doing shit like that, even if it only sells one book, it works. It's worth it, you know. Yeah, I definitely think we're in a very different era right now, technology wise and social media wise and everything, where And I can't compare it to how it was like 10 years ago, because I don't know. I mean, that'd be a question you'd have to ask a guy like McClanahan or Brian Allen Carr and even Maloney. Like, how did you sell Colts of Loretta? But it's like now we have access to all this shit like TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, whatever, and it's all blown up in so many different ways where you kind of have to think like, what else can I do in this already oversaturated environment to get my shit out there, to promote? And that's the other thing too with small presses is like our reach as far as promotion goes is really minimal. At least for me right now, it's pretty minimal. I mean, I do what I can do as far as promotion goes. A lot of it is on the author, I saw, I want to say it was L. Nash gave us a talk not long ago. I think it was a year or so ago on, oh God, was it Ride or Die? Maybe, maybe something like that, where she talked a lot about, how to promote your book when your small press isn't able to promote as much. So yeah, try fucking do everything, man. Throw
What
it at
did
the
she
wall,
say?
see. I remember her, the thing that stood out to me, because I'd never thought of it before, was like submitting essays around sort of what the theme of your book is or something to that extent. And I thought that was interesting to me because I'd never thought of it before. Not saying that like well, I'd never thought of it before just because I'd never seen it before. Not that people don't do it, it's just it was a new idea to me, and also kind of scary because like writing essays are really hard for me, like unless it's about something I want to talk about that's more personal as opposed to like an essay about my book of fiction. I don't know, but yeah, that stood out to me. I think more than anything else. Yeah.
You said earlier you had some ideas about gaining new audiences that were in the works. Can you like elaborate on that?
Yeah, I've got well, trying to think how much I can actually say right now.
Is it too
It's
secretive?
not that it's secretive per se. I just sort of want to wait, like I said, until a couple of things are finalized before. Basically, rejection letters books are going to start being sold in some really cool places that I didn't
Oh, for
expect.
real?
Yeah. So I'm excited about that. Yeah.
How did you feel about the small press distribution thing fallout?
Oh man, I vaguely remember this. Remind me again what it was all about.
The small press distribution where like people can like the small presses, they all had like one centralized thing where they put their books through, and then there was a big fallout and a bunch of shit happened. Did that affect you in any way?
No, that's probably why I don't have much of an opinion on it.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, dude, like I kind of do everything myself when it comes to rejection letters at this point. I haven't really partnered up with anybody or any other big companies. The only thing I've done is I'll go through Ingram to have the books printed. I'm only just now using Asterism for pre-orders. Before, I was doing all the pre-orders myself. And now I'm utilizing Asterism, which is a godsend because I fucking hate mailing out shit.
So how does that work? How does asterism work? And is there a process to get into asterism?
Yeah, so I reached out to them 2 year, a little over a year and a half ago. They were new and they were specifically focusing on a small press book. So I talked with Joshua and I want to say her name was Laura or Lauren, maybe. I think it's Laura, who were running it at the time, and just kind of told them what Rejection Letters was doing. And I already kind of talked to Joshua a little bit because I think he's the one that created Oleata, which is like the submission portal. And I was signed up for that. So I sat down, briefly interviewed with them. It was an interview, like they wanted to know what my plans were to an extent. Is this the, just a one or two book deal, or is this a continuation? And after talking with them, yeah, they said they approved everything. I signed up for their website, set up my own publisher page, and have been taking care of the pre-orders myself. And then after the pre-orders, shipping them a certain amount of books, and then they'll do all the sales from there. But with this particular, with Kevin Carney's book, Freelance, that's coming out at the end of this month, I just set up the pre-order page through there, which was great because people were able to pre-order the book. And then in the next week or so, I'm shipping out, a number that's above the pre-orders. So if it was 300 pre-orders, I'll send, 400 or something, like, just to give you an idea. And that way they have all the extras while being able to individually package and ship out all of those pre-orders. And I don't have to do it. I love that part. I love not having to do that shit.
How long does it take to design the book? And do you do the designs and everything?
Yeah, so far I've done all the designs, with the exception of the plain clothes Hamburglar from Sean Moeller that just came out in March. That was sort of based off an idea he and another guy brought to the table. But yeah, I've done that. The covers haven't taken very long. I typically mm-hmm. work. I always tell the authors, put together your dream board, your inspiration board. Like, what are other covers that you really like? What are things that you personally feel drawn to? Lexi's was super easy. She kind of knew right off the bat what she wanted to do. I think I did that cover in a day. Graham and I worked on his, meaning like he told me his ideas. That took about a week just because we were kind of going back and forth with okay, well, what about this instead of this? But also super easy. Yeah, honestly, they've all been a breeze. Kevin's book was kind of the easiest though, because Kevin went on eBay and bought a bunch of old Polaroids or old printed pics and was like, here's what I got. Which ones do you like best? And I was like, boom, let's do this one. And that became the cover. And yeah, it's just been super, super easy.
What were some of the early designs for Graham's book?
Wow. Trying to think. The one that was that came out was pretty close to the original design. I think if anything, the picture on the cover was mm-hmm. We went through a few different ideas. One of them, I was like, well, let's use a picture of you, like a really disheveled picture of you. And he didn't like that, and I don't blame him. Like, I'm not big on that either. But I put it together and he was like, no, I don't like looking at me. So I was like, okay, fair enough. And so he went downstairs. Actually, I remember this. I want to say it was downstairs in his apartment or wherever he was, and took a picture of whatever the table is on the cover of the book, and then sent it back to me via text. And he's like, "What do you think about this?" I was like, "Okay, give me 10 minutes." And then I worked on it a little bit, edited it, and we had the book. It was easy, man. I've been really fortunate in that regard. Like, everybody's been super easy to work with, and I think a lot of it too is, I kind of tell everybody right off the bat, I'm like, just based on my skill level, and I'm learning more as I go, but based on skill level alone, it's like, I'm very drawn to minimalistic looks. Mm-hmm. And that kind of takes a lot of shit off the board. We're not going to have crazy graphic design kind of stuff. So it helps.
So the more you do this, does it get easier and easier?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense of I have fun doing it every single time. No, in the sense of, 6 months or 8 months will go by before I have to design another cover. And I'm like, fuck, what am I supposed to do in Photoshop again? Mm-hmm. How do I do this? Shit. Because I don't do it outside of just designing these covers. I'm not a graphic design dude. So, yeah. But it's never good.
So is there any point you're just completely overwhelmed and you feel like you're in over your head?
Pre-orders. Fucking hate pre-orders, man.
Yeah? Why?
Well, the way I was doing it, at least, it was, I was, because everything is print on demand still. I can't afford to print out 1,000, 2,000 copies and then ship them all out individually until we run out, first run. So it's all print on demand. And so I hated having to go in and individually order every single book. And especially when you have like, you know, if you have like 300 pre-orders, that's a fucking pain in the ass to do that one by one. Yeah, I hated that, which is why moving over to Asterism is so much easier, because all I have to do is ship them, you know, again, just going back to that, not that trying to imply anything, but just going back to the magic number of 300 pre-orders, right? So let's say there's 300 pre-orders for Kevin's book. All I have to do is go to Ingram and ship the one big shipment of 400 books to Asterism, and they have to package and label all that shit. I don't have to do any of it. So I love that. I get overwhelmed when it's, you know, mountains and mountains of tedious shit like that. And I'm like, my brain doesn't work this way. I don't want to do this. This sucks.
So why don't you just cut out the pre-orders and not do pre-orders?
Pre-orders are fun though. Everybody likes hyping up their book before it comes out.
Yeah.
You know, I don't feel like that'd be fair to the author to take so that away.
Do you have to pay Asterism like part of the percentage or something?
Yeah, so they charge a very, very, very nominal fee. So I think that's one of the reasons that I like working with them, because financially it's still even paying to have the books shipped from Ingram to Asterism, and then the fee that they charge per shipment, it's still levels out to be the same as if I were doing it all myself. I just don't have to deal with the hassle.
So on the print on demand, do you go on to like Amazon and you like design how the pages are going to look and everything?
So I do all that in InDesign.
How'd you learn that?
That one I actually learned from work. So I used to be a curriculum editor for a charter school like almost 10 years ago. And I was designing textbooks and student workbooks and InDesign. So I had that experience doing that portion of it. So it was really more so like jogging my memory, like just muscle memory, you know, and then being able to do that. And after Lexi's book, I got the hang of it again. During Lexi's, putting together Lexi's book, got the hang of it. And I was like, oh, okay, this is actually a lot easier. I think the more time consuming and tedious aspect of that is just like fonts. You know, what kind of fonts does the author like? What looks really well? Designing the different titles and all that kind of shit. But even then, that's not, it's real, honestly, man, like it's not hard. Like I really enjoy doing it. I think that what I enjoy doing most is like seeing when the authors get excited to like actually look at their book and hold their book for the first time. It's a cool feeling, you know, to be like, that's cool. I got to do that for that guy, for that girl. Like that's fucking great, you know? And then to be able to put really rad shit out into the world, it's a nice feeling. It's a really, really cool thing.
How did you get into the business of designing textbooks?
So I was working at a an apartment complex at the time, which is what leasing is based off of. Excuse me. And my ex-wife's sister-in-law, who I was really close with at the time, told me there was a job opening at her office at the charter school and said I should apply because I had a background in English and, you know, a bunch of other shit. And I went in, applied, and got the job. And so I was doing that for a few years. And yeah, that was it.
So do you sit down every day and like design different texts? Like what's the job entail?
So I don't do that job anymore. That job I left in 2016. I work right now at a university and I do strategic communications. So internal communications.
What did the textbook job entail though? Like every day? Was it just like mind-numbingly bullshit designing a textbook?
Yes. Yep. Phases. Mostly phases. So it was like and I vaguely remember it, but it was always like the initial phase is just taking things out of a Word document and putting them into an InDesign template. After that, and you don't have to worry about the designing or anything like that. It's literally just moving one thing one document to another document.
Wow.
Then it got into the I'm trying to think, the copy editing. So I hated the fucking copy editing because it is mine, at least with this shit, like I'm reading cool shit. You know what I mean? Like I'm rereading it at that point. You know, so I'm enjoying what I'm reading. I don't fucking care about 10th grade biology. So having to go through that was a pain in the ass, just to make sure that the curriculum writers made sense and all that stuff. Was never a fan. And then after that, it was like, I want to say that's when we got into the design elements. So fonts and backgrounds and imagery and all that kind of shit. And that was a little easier, a little more fun. But you're dealing with textbooks, man. Yeah, it's fucking, it's boring as shit.
So the school used their own textbooks? Like there's not a bigger company that does that?
No, it was all their own shit. Yep.
And you had to you had to read for it, like for typos and shit?
Yep, sure.
How many typos are you finding?
Dude, you know what's funny is I would find so many fucking typos. And like, so, and I mean, some of it's understandable. I don't expect like a math teacher to be the greatest writer in the world or a science teacher. But when you're an English or a history teacher and you have like real glaring grammatical errors, that's a problem. You know what I mean? Like, that's something that you need to be concerned with and I need to be concerned with. And there was a lot of that going on.
Was there ever like a propaganda like issue where like, you saw something that was clearly like one-sided that like bothered you?
No, I think too, this was like prior to 2016, prior to like Trump coming in. So my mind was not even remotely like configured for scoping that kind of stuff out. And also like, I don't think I actually read any of it to like try to learn or decipher whether or not students, that was never my job. That was always the writer's job. Mm-hmm. So yeah, nothing off the top of my head.
You didn't pick up any residual new information?
I probably should have, man, but no, I fucked that up.
How many people were doing this with you? Was there a team of people?
Yeah, we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 editors, and I want to say 5 or 6 writers.
And it was just like, everyone's at a computer all day. Are they bullshitting with each other?
I would usually joke around, which I would get in trouble for at times. But no, everybody kind of like, I mean, I also worked with a few older people. So like, they were just kind of like chill, very much in their own world. It wasn't a bad thing. It was interesting though. There were like 2 categories of people. It was like people who just kind of chill, minded their business, got their head down, did their work. And then like the sort of like yip yap, nonstop talky people in the office. And like everything was either some fucking office drama or, you know, something to do with their lives that none of us gave a shit about. Mm-hmm. Like I remember there was one girl who was like planning a wedding, which good for her, but would never fucking shut up about all the, you know, wedding stuff she had to put up with. And I'm like, I'm sorry you're having to go through this. I don't fucking know you that well, and I don't care. Good luck and Godspeed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So are there any scandals in the publishing industry of that arm?
Yeah, the owners of that company never went to college, man. They only had high school degrees.
For real?
Yeah, high school diplomas. People who owned that company, to my the best of my knowledge, only ever got diplomas. And I thought that was fucking interesting. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I guess it wasn't a requirement.
So how do you get out of that job? What do you go into after that?
Oh, I got laid off. Our whole team got laid off. Yeah, it was wild.
Why?
They thought they were going to outsource everything. Uh-huh. And so they laid us all off. And then that's when I went back to working at the apartment complex for like 6 months. And then not long after that, started working at the university I'm at now. Just like, you know, typical online job hunting. Started off at the university I'm at right now as a temp. And then 5 months later became full-time. And just been there ever since 2018. Yeah.
Would you ever design
2017.
Would you ever design a rejection letters textbook?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. How to Fuck Up Your Life, 10 Easy Steps.
Do you want to read any of your poetry?
Any of my poetry?
Yeah.
Dude, I haven't read poetry in forever. Are you sure you want to do poetry, or can I do a short story? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Let me see what I've got then. I just wrote.
Do you have Pete?
Pete. Oh, that's a good one. I haven't thought about Pete in a long time. Yeah, let me find Pete.
All right, cool.
Oh, shit.
That story kind of reminded me of like an absurdist way of addressing like being like in an abusive relationship almost.
That's cool. I hadn't thought about that. I could see that though. Yeah, there definitely is the aspect of like the brother taking advantage of Pete over and over. And I will say that was sort of in the back of my mind as the characters were concerned. not necessarily taking a stance on it, just more so painting the in the background, this is what's going on.
Because the narrator keeps getting abused, but then he's like, well, I'll keep doing it because I love these people. It's like, man, that sounds like people that are in abusive relationships.
That's typically how it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Yeah. I got it.
You ready? All right, cool. Yeah.
I don't think I've actually read this one out loud, so I hope I don't fuck it up. All right. Pete. In the foster home, my brother Pete would get genius ideas that made living in the shithole, living in that shithole, not so bad. He'd make up games for us to play when our foster mom locked us in our room or in the basement or outside. When we aged out of the foster system, Pete got genius ideas that helped us stay alive, like how to steal jackets from Walmart so we didn't freeze to death when it started to snow outside. So Pete gets another genius idea. He's going to hold up a liquor store. We'll use the money to move to Mexico and start a whole new life. Pete says I get to be the lookout and the wheelman. I get two jobs. Except Pete's genius idea wasn't as genius as he thought it was, I guess. In the car across the street, engine running, waiting for Pete to come out with that fat stacks, with some fat stacks, I hear gunshots. Then the owner walks out with a shotgun. Then the cops show up. Then I drive fast and far. A few weeks later, Pete wakes me up in the middle of the night and says, yo, wake up, man. There's a hole in Pete's head where his eyes used to be. But other than that, he's the same old Pete. He says, I need you to go get my ashes from the funeral home. I go, you really are dead? He goes, yeah, man. Sorry about that. I try for a little while. Pete tries to put his hand on my shoulder, but it doesn't work because he's a ghost. He says he's sorry for asking me to do this and that he'd do it himself if he could, but he's dead. Plus, he says there's someone he wants me to meet. I say, sure, Pete, I'll get your ashes. I wait until it's dark to break into the funeral home. Everything smells like chemicals and rotten fruit and metal, like the potpourri of death. Pete goes, yo, over here. There's a woman standing next to Pete. She's wearing red lingerie, one titty swinging free, her throat slit. Pete says, little bro, meet Erica. Erica says, hi. I say, hi. Pete asks me to take Erica's ashes too, so they can stay together. He looks at Erica and smiles all stupid at her. Then he tells me they're in love. I put their ashes in Ziploc bags and walk home, listening to Pete and Erica giggle at each other behind me. When I get home, I put Pete's ashes on my nightstand and tell him I'm going back to sleep. He says that's fine. When I wake up, my hair's bleached and I've got a goatee. My gut's so big that I can't see my dick. I'm wearing a green sequin dress. There are rose petals and dildos everywhere. I yell for Pete. No response. I yell and yell until my neighbor bangs on the wall and tells me to shut the fuck up. The date on the Weather Channel says I've been out for 3 months. Pete and Erica appear on the couch. Erica stares into Pete's face hole. Pete looks in her direction. They both moan and call each other baby. I go, what the hell is going on? They break their trance. Pete looks at me with the hole in his head. Pete says, I'm sorry. We're so horny. So horny, Erica follows. Pete tells me that ghosts can't touch each other unless they possess someone else and use that person's body. So they've been possessing me and making me do shit to myself to get each other off. You have a very nice hog, Erica says. Yeah, man. Huge hog. Good job, Pete says. I want to tell him that this is bullshit and I don't want to be possessed and I don't want to dress up like drag Guy Fieri. Instead, I say, okay. I guess ghosts get horny too. Plus, Pete looks so happy. Even dead with the hole in his head, this is the happiest I've ever seen him. I love my big brother. He's always looked out for me. So if this is how I repay him for everything he did for me when he was alive, I'll do it. Erica and Pete take turns possessing my body. They put all kinds of shit up my ass, make me jerk off, dress me up like different animals. I black out dressed as Barack Obama and come to in a diaper with jizz all over my chest. This goes on for months and months, and I'm very tired. One night, Erica and Pete leave my body. I get in the bathtub and cry for a long time. I cry because, A, I'm so tired, but I'm afraid that if I fall asleep, they'll just possess me again and fuck each other by making me fuck myself. And B, I'm super happy because Pete's so happy, but it just reminds me that I'm alone. Pete's dead. He's moved on. Not to the other side, but he's found someone to love. I want someone to love. I want to have sex with a living person, not my ghost brother and his ghost girlfriend. Pete hears me crying and asks what's wrong, and I tell him. Then Pete gets another genius idea. He and Erica will help me get a girlfriend. So then, when they possess us, I'm not just having sex with myself. I'm having sex with a living human woman. Erica thinks this is a great idea. I sign up for all the dating apps. I do speed dating. I'm not picky. Finally, I meet Hazel. Hazel's a foster kid, too. She works at Yogurtland and only has one foot. We fall in love fast. I tell Pete and Erica they can't possess us until we tell Hazel the truth, and only if she's cool with it. I decide not to string her along and just tell Hazel up front. She loves it. She thinks it's hot. She says there's nothing sexier than ghost fucking. Hazel gets on top of me, and I get inside of her, and we both black out. Right as I get ready to come, Pete thanks me for letting him and Erica possess our bodies so they can still experience the beauty that is the physical act of love. He also tells me he's proud of me. Hazel gets pregnant. The four of us sit down and decide what to do. Hazel says she wants to keep the baby. I also want to keep the baby. Pete and Erica get really emotional and think the baby is theirs. Pete says he always wanted to be a dad because he didn't have one. Erica says she's always been a MILF at heart. The baby looks like all four of us. He has a bleached goatee, a hole where one eye is supposed to be, strawberry yogurt-colored hair, and a birthmark around his neck. He's perfect. We cover him with a golden coat of protection and happiness. In life and in death, nothing waits for him but love. I get a genius idea. I name him Pete.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
When you're writing that, how do you balance out the heart? Like, how do you not go too absurdist? How do you not go too cheesy? Like, is it just like intuition for you?
Oof. that one went through a couple rounds of edits. I had a few people help out with that one. But yeah, I do think some of it is just sort of like practicing. Mm-hmm. I love absurdist stuff. It's sort of what I lean into normally. So I think a lot of it has to do with like learning what the sweet spot is for the story, you know, because mm-hmm. there's some shit where I do just kind of go batshit crazy. Like there's no heart, there's no warmth, there's nothing like that. And then there's stories where it's almost a little sappy at first, and you know, then you kind of dial it back if you need to. I also think I'm just sort of an emotional guy anyway. Like I typically, like, you know, I'm not a big crier, even though I talk a lot about crying in a lot of my stories. It's sort of mm-hmm. like something that I just end up doing. But I will say, like, even though I'm not a big crier, I do enjoy a good cry when it happens, you know. And I will get choked up at, like, you know, the first 15 minutes, like Up or something like that. You know what I mean? Just, you know, whatever, little stuff like that. So I think being sentimental already helps in that regard. And maybe it is a little more intuitive in that way. So I think a combination of practice and then just the intuition.
I feel like, are you like trying to like, or like you got to make like the characters a little dumb at first. So as they're learning along, the audience is also learning with them.
For that story, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the way for me, at least, is in stories like that, is it's really hard to write a character that's just grossly intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because then there's different types of intelligence too, right? There's emotional intelligence, there's social intelligence. I don't think many of my characters possess much intelligence outside of maybe emotional intelligence, because I think they all recognize how they feel. And that's something, and through years of therapy and my own shit, having dealt with, like, I know I'm a pretty emotionally intelligent person, so maybe that's why I project a lot of that onto my own characters. Because even in the most absurdest of situations, having that sense of emotional intelligence, you know, there's an acceptance behind it, or an ability to sort of see past it and gain some wisdom, if that makes sense. Whereas if you have maybe like an incredibly intelligent person who's like book smart, you know, education, intelligence, that kind of stuff, they might miss that, you know, it might go over their heads. I also don't think I'm the smartest person in the world, per se, emotional intelligence aside. So I think, you know, I lean into that because I don't consider myself like a grossly intellectual individual. Like, I'm not the kind of person that's going to sit back and debate philosophical standpoints or politics and shit like that. It's just not shit I want to do. So, you know, talking more about feelings is a little easier.
Do you think by using death and themes of death that you can get maybe more out of, if you're trying to like write about life or something, instead of writing about life or being alive, you can get more out of being dead and using characters that are within a realm of death or something?
Yeah, I saw something recently that basically said everything that we do is basically under the shadow of death. Everything we do is because of death, because it's always looming. It's the only certainty that we have. And I think there's a truth to that, because I think when death is so readily available, it does sort of shape your outlook on the world. You know what I mean? And it mm-hmm. shapes how you learn, and maybe what you learn and what you're willing to learn, or whatever the case is.
What do you think happens when we die?
Oh, man. I don't know. I don't want to say evangelical. I didn't grow up evangelical. I grew up Pentecostal and then evangelical and then a little Catholic too. So rooted in mostly Christianity. I love the tenets of what Jesus stood for. I love that, but I don't want to say that necessarily has anything to do with what you do, where you go when you die, or what happens when you die. It's funny too, I had like a mini existential crisis last week when I was in New York. That was fun. Standing in the bathroom. Oh, I was just standing in, I was high, and I was standing in the bathroom, and it was like 3 a.m. and I was just looking at myself in the mirror, and then had this like thought of like, fuck, I'm going to die one day, and like just existence is going to cease. And like, you know, if that's what happens, you know, if nothing happens after we die, then that's it. Boom, lights over, nothing else. I will never go. Everything will go on around me, but that's it. And that's a scary feeling, because you can't, just like most people can't comprehend the idea of eternity, of forever and ever and ever. I don't think anybody else can really truly comprehend the notion of finality either. You know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. we see death in people, but we also have their memories in our minds. You know what I mean? We'll have a joke that has to deal with them, or even a sad story, or even anger, even negative emotions towards somebody. And that way that person lives on forever. But to that person who's dead, if nothing else happens after we die, then they've embraced finality while we're continuing this sense of eternity by, you know, perpetuating memories, right? So anyway, my hope is that we go on somewhere mm-hmm. else. My hope is that consciousness exists in a way that we experience the next part of this journey, whatever it is. I mean, that's the more optimistic side of me. You know, I've argued with myself, like, well, you know, if you're going somewhere after life, how do you know, you know, just the idea of time and how that's a whole thing in and of itself. Again, I'm not a very smart person when it comes to this stuff, but so I just think of it how I best I can. But, you know, you think of like when you die, if your consciousness continues to go forward, then it makes you wonder, well, did your consciousness really only come into existence when your physical body came into existence? Or did it also exist before you came here? And I don't mean necessarily reincarnation or anything like that. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know. But I hope that it's our consciousness moves forward. And I've argued with myself, and when I've had my doubts, you know, well, why don't I remember anything? I'm like, well, I barely remember shit from like 3 weeks ago. So if I existed prior to my physical body, then, you know, what makes me think I'm going to remember that? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. What about you? What do you think?
That was really deep. I wasn't ready for that long of an answer.
Sorry.
That's all right. Yeah. I hope we go on somewhere else. What do you think happens if you just end up in a cubicle somewhere, like designing textbooks again?
Oh, then if that, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
Yeah. So when you sit up to write, like, Pete, like, do you have, like, because you have rules for, like, the ghost. Do you already have the rules in mind? Do you know that you're going to write a ghost story? Do you have any of that figured out?
No. So originally that story was actually going to be way more grounded. It wasn't going to be as absurdist. And it ended up after, like, two rounds of other people reading it, where I was like, I need to switch it up. And then I kind of got into the absurdist aspect of it. And no, I typically just make this shit up as I go along, honestly, feels right.
It did start out real gritty and grounded. And then after the shooting happened, when the ghost popped in, I was like, oh, this is going somewhere I did not expect.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how it was supposed to be. It was, grounded originally. And, it just didn't work out, didn't feel right. And so switched it up, kind of went back to what works for me. And then out came Pete.
Do you ever sit down with something that's going to be absurdist and then it ends up more grounded?
The most grounded thing I've written was leasing. And that was all very much so based off of like actual experiences. So no, I don't think so, man. I think literally every time I've tried to write absurdist, it's been absurdist. When I've tried to write grounded, it's been grounded. Because I've also written a lot of nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
That's supposed to be about, you know, my life and kids and wife and all that stuff and family. And it just, you know, it's grounded.
When you're writing absurdist, do you have specific rules that you try to stick to? So you don't go too outside the box? And like weird out the
no, not really. If I do that, I don't feel like it's truly absurdist.
Oh, really?
You know, for me at least, for me, because I have to sort of like really feel out the story. You know, I may get an idea that I think is really cool in the beginning and be like, yeah, I think halfway through the story, the character should do this. But then when I get to that point, I'm like, nah, fuck it. We're going to go this way. And, you know, especially with short stories, man, short stories are like, you only have so much time. You only have so much space to tell a story and really just presenting like a fragment of time, you know? So fucking no rules at all, man. Balls to the wall, just go for it. You know,
who are some of your favorite writers that have dealt with death and afterlife in the short story form?
In the short story form. Okay. Oh God. I don't know. I have a novel that I think about a lot, but let me think of short stories.
Say the novel.
Haruki Murakami's Hard-Boiled Wonderland and the End of the World. I love that one because it deals with the idea of like consciousness and also what it means to be alive and reality. And that one fucked me up a little bit. Kelly Link's book Get in Trouble deals a lot with like ghosts and stuff. I wouldn't say the theme is necessarily death. but yeah, I think that's another good one.
Are there any songs?
Ooh, yeah. Damien Jurado's The Last Great Washington State. I love that album. That album is one of my the album The Horizon Just Laughed is what it is. That is one of my all-time favorite albums anyway, but that one, I want to say I read that he wrote that song about his friend and producer Richard Swift. Adam Voigt would probably know this. Adam Voigt is like a big music guy. But I love that one because it's, I mean, it's very abstract, so you can sort of take whatever meaning you want from it. But I love this idea of just sort of like memories being passed along. At least that's kind of what I took a lot from it. yeah, that's a really, really, really good one. Oh, and then his whole Maricopa trilogy also deals with death and dying in the afterlife, if you've ever listened to it. And then the producer is Richard Swift for that one as well. And those are, in my opinion, his best three albums, just as out of all his catalogs. Not all my favorite, but they're the best three, a lot because of Richard Swift.
Any ska bands that deal with death?
Ska bands. You know, it's funny. What was I listening to yesterday? And I think I was on Spotify, some random playlist, and got into ska. And I was just like, damn, like not any deep cuts, nothing deep, but like Real Big Fish. I think The Undertones was one band that popped up. And for me, it was like very nostalgic. But I will say, I want to say it's, I could be very, very, very wrong about this, but the big Mighty Mighty Bosstones song, the impression that I get was about dealing with AIDS. I want to say that was like what that whole song was about. So it's funny you bring up ska. The impression that I get by Mighty Mighty Bosstones.
What was it? Did you say age?
AIDS.
AIDS.
HIV, yeah.
Okay. What? How so?
Again, it's a vague memory of like when I was a kid, somebody being like, that song's about AIDS. Excuse me. But I want to say the whole point of it is like him being afraid to get tested because like, you know, everyone around him or people, not everyone, but people around him were catching AIDS. Again, I could be completely off.
Is that like lore, like that like teenagers pass around, like when you're a teen, it's like this song's about this.
Yeah. Like when Marilyn Manson took out his rib so he could suck his own dick. Yeah. Yeah. That was one of those things. Yeah. Yeah.
Would you ever write about it? Like a 33rd and a half series?
Wait, what?
Would you ever write about that ska song in like 33 and a half series? You know, those books where they write about albums or whatever?
You know, I don't think I could ever say, I've tried to write about like music. Maybe ska. Didn't somebody write a ska book? It was published by Clash. It was like in defense of ska.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, I'm almost positive. I don't think I could. Somebody's already taken care of it. I'd have to do something else like in defense of, I don't know, what's a really shitty band that I could like write about. In defense of, you remember that band Live from the 90s?
No.
Oh man, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I was born in 89.
Okay. Okay. So you're only 6 years younger than me. So yeah, you might remember some of it. But like it's like very much so like, oh, Creed. Fucking you could write a book about Creed, just straight up butt rock. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Vanilli or whatever they're called.
Milli Vanilli, remember them? In defense of maybe that's what the next series needs to be, like in defense of boy bands or in defense of like bubblegum pop.
Yeah.
All that shit that came out.
Or those like rock songs that like Monday Night Raw would play at the beginning of their shows.
Dude, they still play that shit. It's amazing.
Yeah. How'd you get into wrestling?
I grew up watching it, man. My dad was a big wrestling guy. So I remember watching like Saturday morning, like when Hulk Hogan and Ultimate Warrior and Macho Man Randy Savage and Roddy Piper and all that shit were going on. And then a few years later, I was in a youth group at my Pentecostal church, and they were all into like WCW. So it's like Sting. It's like right when the NWO first started.
Oh, nice.
And so into that. And then my friends at school were into WWF with like DX and Stone Cold Steve Austin. So like, you know, church was very WCW because it was more of the Christian brand.
And really?
Home. That's how it felt growing up. They didn't like the whole DX,
yeah, suck it,
Stone Cold, Steve Austin, guzzling beers and shit. but I watched both, which was funny because like my favorites at the time were Sting and Steve Austin. Still are two of my absolute favorites of all time. Just so much nostalgia with both those guys. And then when I, you know, went into high school, I was kind of like all over the place. So I didn't focus on it anymore. And then about 3 years ago, my son started getting really into John Cena. And so I just started picking it up again to watch it, and then we both really fell in love with it. Now I'm hooked again, you know. So
you weren't watching it during the dark days, like the 2010s and shit?
No, I didn't catch. That's why it took me a while to catch up. Like, I didn't know who Randy Orton was. I didn't know anything about Cody Rhodes, Roman Reigns, all those big dudes now. Like, I had no clue. Like, it's why it's funny still. Like, even the past couple of years for, like, the Royal Rumbles, when they'll have somebody come in that hasn't been around in a long time, I'm like, I don't know who the fuck this is, but yeah, I love this for them, you know? So.
Do you watch AEW at all?
No, I've got a buddy of mine who's a diehard wrestling fan and has been since we were in high school. He tells me there's some good shit on AEW and like TNA and all that stuff, but I'm already spread thin enough, man. I'm just going to stick to the one thing and watch WWE. Just leave it at that.
We've been going for a while. Is there anything you want to plug?
Yeah, Kevin's book coming out at the end of this month. Freelance, a novel. It's fantastic. Any of the Rejection Letters books are amazing. My book is Leasing. Love my book. Big fan of my book. Trying to think, man. That's it. I don't know. That's it.
Anything like inspirational you want to say? Any last words?
Oh, man. Be nice to each other. We need to be nice to each other. We're too mean. Social media sucks. I keep going on and off of it because people are fucking mean. And I feel almost like a kid saying that, but it's also like I have kids, you know? Mm-hmm. So, be nice. And I need a fucking throat lozenge, apparently. I'm sorry. You've had to listen to me like coughing and clear my throat every 5 seconds.
Are you afraid of your kids like finding your stories?
No, they all know about them. They haven't read any of them, but I'm like, no, when you're older, you can read them. Just not right now. Because my oldest is 13, which is still way too young to read a lot of my shit.
Is it hard to find time to write when you have kids?
Yes, I'm having a really hard time right now. I wrote two short stories. Well, I wrote one short story the other day on the plane and 3/4 of one yesterday. And I don't know. I think it just depends. Like, I'm slowly working through a horror novel right now. And then I have an idea for another absurdist one that I want to start that's going to be a lot shorter. And yeah, it's just a matter of finding time. You know,
Has it always been easy just to sit down and write one out?
A short story?
Yeah.
I think so. I think that's the thing about assertus. I say yes, but I also know like sometimes you got to go back and make corrections and, you know, edits and shit like that. But I think that's the thing with absurdism that's really fun. It's like there's no, at least to me, because all, you know, you just say the hell with all the rules. Mm-hmm. Like there's no like confines of anything. It's really sky's the limit. Do what you want. I think the only thing where I'm just kind of like, oh, this is too much is if I become long-winded, you know. And I think I had that problem too after writing Leasing, where I was, you know, I wrote a whole ass novel. So everything started turning into a novel and I was like, fuck, dial it back, dude. Keep it short, you know.
How do you do that?
So keeping it short.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes when I write, like I try to be, it has to be important, or I'm too precious and it has to be long and I have to go in these long explanations. How do you just keep it short?
Lean into the absurdism. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it starts to become too precious and like if it's nonfiction and I'm telling a story about my life, then I let myself go longer because that's coming from a different place. If it's fiction, nah. Like, just lean into the absurdism, cap it off where it needs to be capped off, and be done with it.
How much detail do you feel like you have to give to the surrounding areas before you can move on? Like, when you're grounding someone in the scene?
Like, in fiction, you mean?
Yeah. Or nonfiction.
Depends. Sometimes I don't give any background. Sometimes I just go into it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just kind of expect the reader to accept things as they are. If they don't, that's on them. That's okay. You know, maybe the story will never get published.
Yeah.
You know, if I have a good time writing it and I like it, I leave it as is. Again, I don't have a lot of the rules in my head.
Do you think that would overcomplicate you?
Rules? Hell yeah.
Yeah.
It's too much of a block, man.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, have you ever taught writing?
Creative writing? No. I wanted to for a while, and then I thought, I don't know if I'd be a really good teacher or not, because I feel like I would just kind of always be like, yeah, man, just do what you want, go for it, have fun, you know? Mm-hmm. And I guess that's not exactly what they teach in creative writing.
Well, maybe you could do like online workshops.
Yeah, that could be something later on. I don't know. I mean, it's A, time-wise to do something like that. B, I also have the thought where I'm like, who the fuck would want to listen to me? You know, so who knows? Maybe. Life's long, man.
Would you ever teach one with Aaron and Kevin?
Full circle. Sure. I'll give it to him. Yeah. I'd probably just sit back and just be like, yeah, whatever they say. Just what you like from what they say, take it. What you don't, fuck them. You don't have to do that shit.
How's writing a story with them? Because I saw you wrote one.
Dude, it was so much fun. We wrote a whole book. Yeah, it was yeah, it was fun. It was a breeze. Honestly, writing with those guys is super easy.
Any arguments?
We all no. Well, not real arguments. Arguments more so like I wanted the books to be shorter originally, mm-hmm. but we kept having fun and it kept going on and on and on and on and on. And then at one point I was like, guys, we gotta fucking cap this off, man, because it's getting to be a little long-winded. And they're like, okay, cool. Here's 7 more chapters. But no, I mean, honestly, and that's all playful shit. Like, it was super fun. They're ridiculously easy to write with. And I think all 3 of us were in the right headspace to write together, which we've written a short story together. We wrote the novel together. I think when we have time to write together, we're typically all in the right headspace and we feed off of each other very well. And a lot of it was just each other trying to make each other laugh. Like, that's really what we're trying to do, is just like impress one another.
You said they sent you like 7 chapters. Like, are you ever like exhausted by the amount of work you have to read?
No. I mean, we took turns writing chapters. I say 7 chapters, meaning the story went on for that much longer.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, I joke around in the story, because it got very meta for a while. My character in the story would bitch about how long the story was getting.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more so just like kind of tongue in cheek, not very serious at all. No, I mean, I think that was the only thing where I was like, fuck, I am going to have to format all of this. But even then, it was easy, man. I did it in like a couple of days.
And the work they send you, is it always like well written, or are there like typos and shit?
I mean, maybe a couple typos, but nothing huge. And a lot of it was we went back and revised our own shit after we were done with the story. But no, man, we didn't take ourselves very seriously with writing this novel. It was like, we're just going to have fun. It's a limited release for AWP only. We made 50, no, was it 50? Yeah, we printed out 50 copies, sold 50 copies, and that was it. It's never going to see the light of day outside of that, you know, last AWP.
And one last question, would you ever start your own podcast?
No, I can't do what you guys do, man. I have so much respect for you guys to do this.